It's good to be back with you again today. Sarah asked me to mention that she did make copies of the page of the handout that got inadvertently left out last week, and they're in the back on a chair. So if page 3, yes, and it has 4 on it too. So if you actually want to know what I skipped last week, then you can pick up a handout. And you'll notice those things. It does have the beginning of that fourfold, five painfully difficult steps for recognizing and letting go of your agendas. So you're welcome to pick one of those up. I think we'll begin with a poem today. It is not on your hand. Do we have handouts? Do all of you have today's handout? Okay. This poem is not on your handout, but it's not the kind you need to meditate on. It's just kind of fun. So we'll start with this poem. I might have used this 2 years ago. Do y'all remember things for 2 years? Obviously, I don't.
No.
It's a memorable poem, but it's worth hearing again. It's called God Says Yes to Me, by Kaylin Hout. God Says Yes to Me. I asked God if it was okay to be melodramatic, and she said yes. I asked her if it was okay to be short, and she said it sure is. I asked her if I could wear nail polish or not wear nail polish, and she said, honey, she calls me that sometimes. She said, you can do just exactly what you want to. Thanks, God, I said. And is it even okay if I don't paragraph my letters? Sweet cakes, God said. Who knows where she picked that up? What I'm telling you is yes, yes, yes. God says yes to me. I like to use that poem in context when I'm talking about spiritual disciplines and people get anxious about doing it the right way. You talk about a discipline like reading scripture. There's this ancient practice called Lectio Divina, and it has 4 steps. And people, when they encounter it for the first time, they get nervous. Am I doing it right? I just want people to relax and just give the practice a try. If someone mentioned centering prayer to me, there are all these... do this way and then introduce the prayer word at this time, and you can start getting panicky about whether you're doing it right. Just live into the practice. So, we began a couple weeks ago by looking at spirituality and spiritual formation in general, and suggesting that spiritual formation, more than something that we do to propel ourselves down the path of holiness or to make our lives better, the practice of Christian spirituality, the engagement of spiritual disciplines, is more about the work. And it can feel like hard work, but the work of letting go of the work. The work of becoming increasingly open and receptive and available and responsive to the transforming work of God's Spirit in our life. That's the work of these spiritual disciplines, entering into these practices of prayer, opening to God, responding to the ever-present Spirit at work and moving in our lives. And so last week I suggested that, we've used this language of false self a little bit. Last week I suggested that our false selves, those clinging, grasping false selves, they pull things into their own orbits, and we essentially close in on ourselves to secure our own identities, to live the lives we've imagined for ourselves. And I called that living with agendas. And I said living with agendas or attachments, to use the language of the spiritual traditions, keep us from being open and available to God because they're living life on our own terms. They also keep us from being open and available to others in free, self-giving love. So one of the practices of becoming open to God is learning to recognize when we're in the grip of an agenda, when attachments, when we love something for its own sake outside of the horizon of God's love and creative activity, when these attachments close us down, we begin to recognize that because they can wreak havoc in our lives. And we learn, once we recognize that, we can learn in prayer to begin to make space for the Spirit to free us from those attachments so that we can respond to God, open and receptive and responsive to the Spirit's work in our life. So today we're going to move on and look at a different spiritual practice. And I want to get into this by telling you about one of my favorite moments in a book by Frederick Buechner, that wonderful Presbyterian minister and writer over. He's in his 80s now. He's written so many beautiful novels, but his memoirs are just jewels of insight on the spiritual life. And in one book, he writes a book called, Telling Secrets. In his memoir, Telling Secrets, he writes about the Tower of London and the oldest part of the tower built by William the Conqueror in the 11th century called the White Tower. And the White Tower is a two-story building, and in the second story of the White Tower is the Chapel of St. John. I can imagine a place like this, actually, only if the windows were open so he had the light streaming in. He says, it's peaceful, it's open, it's airy. There's light streaming in through, and air streaming in through the arched windows. He says, in this Chapel of St. John, you can't enter it without being overcome by a sense of peace and purity that it gives. On the other hand, just below the Chapel of St. John is the worst of the tower's dungeons. It measures 4 by 4 by 4 foot square, not very big. It has a heavy oak door that slams shut, blocking out almost all air and the light. So there's no room to move or to stretch out. There's no light. There's very little air to breathe. A suffocating confinement. And this dungeon is called the Little Ease. The Little Ease. And then Buechner writes, I am the White Tower, of course. I am the White Tower, of course. And the suggestion is that we all are in some way the White Tower. But instead of accepting God's invitation to live in the spacious, peaceful chapel above, we spend a great deal of our lives living in the dungeon below, locked in and afraid, suffocating in the dark. And I think that's what we're talking about last week when I talked about the false self, because living as false selves is living in the narrow, constricted life that we've imagined for ourselves. And it's a fearful existence, always trying to secure and protect the identities we've created, holding on to what we want. It can be suffocating. It's claustrophobic. We live too much of our lives in the little ease. So one of the ways of talking about this spiritual journey is to say the Spirit invites us to move from life in the little ease to the increasing freedom of the chapel above. To move from a life of always hoarding and grasping and protecting and walling off to a life of receiving life itself as gift, receiving others as gift, receiving our very selves as gift, receiving God's presence as gift, open in the chapel. That also means moving from a life of holding on and holding back and closing off to a life of giving, a life of free self-offering, not afraid of loss, not afraid of self-discovery, moving from the little ease to the chapel above. If you're thinking in the terms of the Gospel of John, you would call this a move from darkness to living in the light, right? That's the movement in the Gospel of John, from life in darkness to living in the light. Or the Gospel of John would also use this image of life in the world to life abiding in Christ. The image that Paul would use for this movement is life in the old Adam, to use the language of Romans, or the old man, so to speak, to life in Christ, the new man, the reborn human being, living in the freedom of God's Spirit. Or to use the language I've been using the last 2 weeks, it would be movement from life as a false self, clinging, grasping, walling off, protective, to a life that is increasingly open and available and responsive to the transforming work of God's Spirit, that Spirit always leading us to our truest selves in God. So one of the practices I want to talk about today that can help us on that journey, that can help us along that movement, and it's a practice that's dear to my heart, perhaps more important to me than at least in my in my own spiritual growth than any other practice is the practice of spiritual companionship or having a soul friend. There are different ways to talk about it. Or the practice of spiritual direction as it's increasingly becoming called today. So that's what we're going to spend our time looking at today. So we live in a culture, as you know, that celebrates individuality and autonomy and self-sufficiency. I can make it on our own. As my mother is aging, I watch how this move to increasing dependency on other people is seen as the marker of decline. I want to be on my own. I want to be independent. I don't want to be a burden to other people. When in other cultures, and even earlier in our cultures, this movement of aging to dependency within the family was not seen as a burden at all. It was just seen, this is what we do, right? We live together. We care for one another. But now, because of our culture wants us to be... So we live in a culture of independency and autonomy. So it seems countercultural in a way to acknowledge what I believe is a fundamental truth. That human beings are made for companionship. We are not made to be autonomous individuals. We are made to be with and for one another. Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, said that humans are by nature social animals. And he said in his Nicomachean Ethics that you can't have true blessed human happiness. You cannot be what we are intended to be without friendship. We must have friendship. One of you, I don't think you're here, mentioned this longitudinal Harvard study that lasted 75 years, where they followed Harvard graduates and kept up with them every 5 years. And of course, over the years, the metrics they were noticing changed. But one of the things they consistently noted that correlated with happiness and longevity, there's only one thing that remained consistent, and that is the capacity to have deep and intimate friendships. They were all men. They were all upper middle class white men. So of course the sample is skewed, but it's still telling that the capacity to have intimate friendships is what made these men happy. What was correlated at least with happiness. When God created humanity, God said, it is not good for Adam, this being I have created, to be alone. It is not good for Adam, man, but it didn't mean like the male being. It meant mankind, human being, humankind, to be alone. So there's this fundamental need for human companionship. Companion, in fact, means one who shares bread with. So a companion is one who breaks bread with you, sits around the table, enjoys with you the very source of life. So in a way, it's countercultural to say so, but we need one another. We need companionship. In this life of moving from the false self to the true self, from locked in to open and available, we will need one another on the journey. There is no doubt about it. It's one of the reasons I believe God made the church. He didn't just save little individuals, but God saves us by incorporating us into a body with one another. So this need for human companionship, it's recognized generally, sociologically, but theologically it's rooted in our very understanding of who God is. That God's very self is community of self-giving love without loss. That's what it means for God to be Trinity. Father, Son, and Spirit, living eternally in self-giving love without fear of loss. That's one of the differences between God and us, is that we tend to think that when we love, or when we give of ourselves, we lose something. But God shows us that this self-giving happens without loss. So community of self-giving love without loss. But it goes even deeper. I'm thinking of the story on the eve of the disciples, the eve of the resurrection, that Sunday evening. The story of the walk to Emmaus, you know, from Luke chapter 24. These two disciples are walking from Jerusalem, the 7 miles from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and they've heard these stories. Could it be true? Is it Is it myth? These stories that maybe Jesus is alive, maybe, or that he's been, or that his body's been stolen. They don't know. And they were sad. They said, "Oh, but we had hoped that this would be the time for the restoration of Israel." But we had hoped. And as they're walking, and I can imagine them walking sadly with their heads down, right? I mean, there's this dejection. And then mysteriously a third begins to walk with them, a stranger whom they don't recognize. And he begins to ask them what they're talking about. And they say, "Are you the only one in Jerusalem who hasn't heard about what's going on?" And he asks them more. And then that's when they say, "But we had hoped. We had such hope." And then this stranger, mysterious, knowledgeable stranger, begins to teach them the scriptures. In that 3-hour walk from Jerusalem to Emmaus, he walks them through the whole of the Bible to show that these things that happened to Jesus were meant to happen. And that this was the way God was saving the world. And there was such power in this conversation that when they got to where they were going, they didn't want this strange, mysterious man to leave. So they said, "Stay with us." So he goes into the house to be their companion, to break bread with them. But in that moment, the guest becomes the host. And as soon as this mysterious stranger takes the bread and blesses the bread, and breaks the bread, and gives the bread, their eyes are open. And remember what the scripture says, he was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. His presence among them became clear in companionship, in this fellowship around the table. And so there's this acknowledgement, not only that God and God's self is a community of self-giving love, a koinonia of love, but that God longs to walk aside us. That indeed God is already walking alongside us, always is, but wants to be known, wants our eyes to be open, wants us to increasingly recognize God's presence and companionship with us so that we can, as I've said over and over again, be available to that presence, open, responsive to the presence of God in our midst. And this is what one of the things that the practice of spiritual direction helps us to do. The practice of spiritual friendship. A medieval abbot, Aelred of Ravaux, begins a treatise on spiritual friendship with these words: "You and I are here, and I hope that Christ is between us as a third." He's a 12th century abbot in England. "You and I are here, and I hope that Christ is between us as a third." But he knew that his hope was fulfilled because Christ's promise in Scripture, "Wherever two or three are gathered in my name, I am with them." So our companionship, our being with one another, our journeying together is a way of acknowledging and being open to the presence of Christ in our midst, the third one among us to whom we can be increasingly open. So out of the general human need for companionship that sociologists and psychologists can tell us about, and out of the need for companions in lives on the journey from brokenness to health and wholeness, emerges this understanding of the Christian practice of spiritual companionship as the journey takes this particular shape we've been talking about, the shape of the movement from false to true self, from little ease to journey of to the chapel of John above, on the journey from closed in. Augustine, as I said last week, says the sin is the heart turned in on itself, from closed in on ourselves to open and available to others and to God in love. To make this journey, we need companions. In spiritual companionship, we are accompanying one another. We are accompanying one another as we discover, discern, and respond to God's accompanying of us. So in spiritual companionship, we accompany one another. We walk together. We journey together as we, and in order to, discover and discern and respond to God's accompanying us at all times. So I want to go through some of the ways this practice, this emphasis on spiritual companionship and its necessity, has taken shape in the Christian spiritual traditions. It really emerges in Christian monasticism in the 3rd and the 4th centuries. So in the 3rd and 4th centuries, you remember from your ancient history classes, the Roman Empire is becoming increasingly Christian. In 312, Constantine wins a battle. He thinks that this sign from God helped him win a battle. So Christianity, almost overnight, goes from being a persecuted minority to first a legal and tolerated religion, and then increasingly the religion of those in power, the state church. Well, early in those centuries, Christians as a persecuted minority felt like they were following Jesus, right? Jesus himself was persecuted, a marginalized figure. So how do you continue, they said, to walk the way of the cross? This is a very relevant question, by the way. How do you continue to walk the way of the cross when your church is now in bed with the empire? When your church is the church of power, right? When you're the chaplain to the emperor, right? How do you walk the way of the cross? And so what these Christians began to do is they began to go out and desert monastics. Thank you very much. And he went out in the 3rd century, and he became famous, and so rather than get away, other people followed him. They wanted to learn from him, and a group of guys grew up around him, so they began to establish loosely related communities. So they were hermits. They lived in little cells or in caves, but they lived close to one another, so they could gather on Sundays, for instance, for communion. But one of the most important things they did was visit one another for spiritual companionship. Because think about it. You go out in the desert. Really, you're following Jesus. I was just reading The Temptation of Jesus. The Spirit led him into the wilderness where he was tempted by the desert devil. And they said, we're going to go out and we're going to fight the demons. This is going to be a place of transformation. Well, you don't really want to do that on your own. It's a liminal space, and there's danger. You can easily be deceived and self-deceived, and you can believe the demons can come to you and look like an angel of light. And there are stories of this all the time, where a monk gets in quite a bit of trouble because he's listening to a demon thinking it's an angel. So what do you need? You need an elder. You need an Abba. You need a wiser monk who's lived there, who knows the ways of the Spirit, who knows the tricks of the devil, kind of like in Screwtape Letters, right? You see C.S. Lewis's book, Screwtape Letters, you see the machinations of the devil and this poor Christian who's trying to figure it out. What he really needs is a spiritual mentor, someone who knows what's going on and can help him. So in the desert, it was this practice of having an Abba. You wouldn't dare go out to the desert without having an Amma, a mother or a father figure, whom you went to on occasion. And they would say, Abba, give me a word. Abba, give me some wisdom to help live this life. And so that was one of the first places where a form of spiritual companionship happens. This recognition, I need guidance on this journey, or I won't make it alone. So one of the aspects of this practice is what they called manifestation of thoughts. I mean, what you would do is you would go to your Abba, and you would just tell them all the thoughts that you've had. Right, you would share with them everything on your heart, right? And you would sift through that together to begin to ask, where in this mess of thoughts and desires and feelings is God leading, and where in this mess am I being led down a trail I'd rather not go? Right? You don't keep secrets back from your spiritual Abba. That's one of the core principles, one of the sayings of the desert. So the wisdom of these desert monks is collected in a little book called the Sayings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. All right, they're just little stories and aphorisms. And one of the sayings is that nothing makes the devil so happy as when a monk keeps his thoughts secret from his spiritual father. And there's actually a great deal of psychological insight there, because I think many of us know the power of a secret, right? If we have our own secret, if it's a secret sin or just a secret thought that we harbor and we're afraid of it and we don't want to share it with other people, it begins to have increasing power over us. It takes up more space in our mind and in our psyche. But as soon as we let that thought or that secret see the light of day, whether it's in a counseling situation or with a spiritual friend or with a pastor, right? We share it. Its power disappears, and it doesn't threaten us anymore. So one of the things that happens in this kind of relationship is that we have the space where we can freely and without fear of judgment share our secret thoughts, so to speak, to discern God's presence within us. So that was one of the practices. The other practice in the desert that was important was obedience. There was a very hierarchical relationship between the Abba and the monk. And if the Abba said, do this, you did it. It was considered to be essential to survival in the desert. Now, we could talk about the pluses and minuses of obedience, but one of the things that was most important to these monks was the letting go of self-will. I mean, they felt like that. We might call it letting go of the false self or the ego self, right? But crucial to wearing down and breaking down the self-will was obedience to another, right? Letting go of your will and doing what another said. So that's one of the places where this practice of having a spiritual companion really started. Now, as monasticism moved from being hermits to being what we think of as monasticism in a community together, they still had this practice. Only the Abba became the abbot, right? And he was the father of all of the monks. And they were to be obedient to the abbot and meet with the abbot and share their thoughts with the abbot to discern how the spirit was leading them. But the abbot's job was to know each monk and to love them and to know their weaknesses and their strengths and to gear his advice and his counsel to the particularities of each monk's situation. So this is one of the places where this practice began to thrive in Christian spiritual traditions. In monasticism. So in both forms of this spiritual guidance, it's charismatic, not in the way we think of charismatic, but it's based on a gift of the Spirit. The Abba in the desert didn't go to a training school to learn how to be a spiritual guide, right? It was a gift that he had. So you went to an Abba who had this gift, but it was also institutional. It had a structure, especially in the monasticism. There was someone who was the abbot, the spiritual guide. So there were also practices of spiritual companionship in the tradition that are less hierarchical, that aren't based on this hierarchy. And I think of this in terms of the Celtic spiritual traditions. That's where we get the phrase anam cara, or soul friend. Now, it predates Celtic Christianity. So the Celts in Ireland and Wales and in Scotland, they had anam cara, soul friends, before the Christians ever got there. But it was a practice amenable to the Christian faith. So St. Brigid, I think a 6th century Celtic figure, is believed to have said, a person without a soul friend is like a body without a head. Think about that. Yes. How'd you get to be an abbot? No, you didn't go to school for it. So in the monastery, in the desert, you would just have been known. You would have been recognized. Someone would have known Abba so-and-so has been there a long time. He's wise. Go see Abba so-and-so, right? The desert itself was a school, so to speak, and he's lived there long enough that he knows the ropes. In the monastery, the monks elect their abbot. So that's part of what's charismatic and institutional. Hopefully they recognize the person who has the gifts to lead a community in this way, and then they elect the abbot of the community. So in Celtic Christianity, though, it's much less institutional. The Roman Church did not really make it to that part of the empire. This is just the fringes of the empire. And so they had a much more egalitarian approach to Christianity. It wasn't until well, the Battle of Hastings and William the Conqueror, and the Roman Church began to take over, and the more European structures of monasticism began to shape that part of the world. So they had soul friends, and they were not hierarchical, but this person who journeyed with you, who was a wise... So the Druids were the soul friends before Christianity got there, these wise figures who you sought guidance from to help you along the journey of spiritual formation. So soul, spiritual companionship can be informal and non-hierarchical. So in the desert, it was more formal. I know who my Abba is, and I'm going to the Abba, and I'm the monk, and he's the Abba. But it's very possible that if we took a survey in here, some of you would say, yeah, I have soul friends. I know who they are, and we share our struggles with one another, and we share our hopes with one another. And when I need prayer, or when I need advice, this is someone who knows my heart probably better than I know my own heart. And so when I'm trying to discern a path in life, or I'm going through a struggle, or I want to share a joy, I have those people in my life with whom I can share these things. They're soul friends. They're people with whom we can relate on a level deeper than the superficial with which we have most of our lives. It's one of the challenges in our culture, especially when you get to be middle age and you're moving around a lot, in a more transient culture, to have these kind of and maintain these kinds of relationships. So there can be this informal, just soul friendships, but it can also be more formal, but still non-hierarchical and kind of ad hoc, where you might have just a friend who you meet with once a month, and maybe you go for a walk. And as you're going for your walk, you talk about your life, and that your friend listens to you. And as you're coming back from your walk, your friend talks about her life, and you listen to her, and you share together. Maybe you even pray for one another at the end of your walk. You're listening for where God is. So there can be this beautiful mutual relationship. I had a spiritual director who, when I talk about spiritual direction, I often talk about Larry. Larry was my spiritual director for 8 years when I lived in North Carolina. And then when I moved up here, and we'll talk about the more formal relationship of spiritual direction in just a little bit. But when I moved up to Pennsylvania, he really couldn't be my spiritual director anymore. And so I found a new spiritual director here in Pennsylvania. So I remember talking to Larry on the phone, and I said, Larry, we've been, you know, meeting once a month for so long, and I know that you're not my spiritual director anymore, but is there a way that we can stay soul friends? And so now Larry and I talk on the phone every other month, and I talk for a half an hour, and he talks for a half an hour, and we share our lives with one another. And it's been a beautiful gift for me, because in spiritual direction, he was my spiritual director, so I was the one doing all the talking, and I didn't ever really learn that much about his life. And so now we just have this beautiful mutual relationship of soul friends that is, I believe, sustaining both of us along the journey. So there are those practices of mutual. So we've had institutional and hierarchical. We've had informal and mutual forms of spiritual direction. And then in the tradition, there have been corporate forms of spiritual companionship. And these are really important. So we Methodists had, from the very beginning, John Wesley said, all holiness is social holiness. And by that he meant all growth on the journey of faith happens within and among the community of believers. That's the necessary context for our journey into holiness, our growth in holiness. And so Methodists, from the very beginning, we divided all of the folks in the movement up into classes and bands, and they met once a week with one another, and they asked this question. They went around the circle. Any of you know the question they asked? No former Methodists who've been hanging out in class meetings? Well, it was 200 years ago that we did this. They went around the circle and said, how is it with your soul? How is it with your soul? That was the question. That's how you know your soul friends, when you can ask questions like that. Not just, how was your day? Not just reporting the facts or the incidences of your lives. It's important and necessary. But how is it with your soul? Now, that question can take a lot of forms, but that's the soul friend question. At the depth of your life, where you're touching God, where you're noticing, where love is trying to grow, or where love is being blocked, how is it with your soul? And again, the tradition said, we need places and people with whom we can ask and answer that kind of question in freedom. So the Methodists have this. The Quakers. You've heard of Quaker clearness committees? A clearness committee is a practice in the Quaker tradition, in which someone who is trying to discern a path forward in life, maybe a vocation or some move, will gather three or four what they call weighty friends. You know, friends love silence. They're known for their listening to the Spirit. Gather weighty friends who will meet with you for maybe even up to 3 hours. And all these weighty friends do is ask you open and honest questions so that your soul can begin to discern the movement of God. They don't give you advice. They don't tell you what they think you should do. They don't tell you when they think you're wrong. They just simply ask you questions so that you can become, it's called a clearness committee, so that you can become clear. So think about when you have a decision to make. You're trying to discern a path forward. You might be wondering where God is leading, but it's all a jumble. Imagine a glass of water, a jar of water with dirt in the bottom. You feel like that's been shaken up, right? And it's cloudy. I don't know how to go forward. Well, the role of a clearness committee or a soul friend in general is to create the space and the conditions where that muddiness can begin to settle to the bottom. And you can gain some clarity about those things. So that's what a clearness committee is for. But if you have a soul friend, you know that your own soul friend does this for you. The questions she asks, the period of the just being available for conversation helps that muddiness to settle so you can have some clarity. I was just this week discerning, wondering if I should stay in a continuing education program that I'm in, and I've been getting kind of confused and anxious about it, and I had a meeting with my spiritual director this week, and as I left after our hour-long conversation, I never said in the meeting, oh, I've come to this conclusion, or she never said, I think you should do this, but as I drove away, I just knew that the cloudiness had settled, and I knew what I was going to do. And it was that space that she created for that clearing to happen. So there's clearness committee in the Quaker traditions. There are also forms of group spiritual direction and spiritual guidance where you can meet with other people for this very intention of we're going to meet once a week, the four of us, and we're just going to use this time to help one another discern how God is active in our lives. So there are forms of corporate, communal spiritual guidance. And then there is the way this practice is becoming increasingly available in practice today under the term of spiritual direction. So I'm just curious about that phrase. How many of you, before I started talking about it, have heard of or heard of having a spiritual director or the practice of spiritual direction? Is that familiar to a number of you? So a number of you have heard of this. It's about the practice of having a spiritual director. Well, for a great deal of history, this was a Catholic practice, and your spiritual director was a priest or a nun, and it happened in monasteries. It seemed to be like a little jewel that only the Catholics knew about. But in the last 40 or 50 years, it's become a much more widely available and known practice that you can be in this more formal relationship with someone who is your spiritual director. So, for instance, when I was in rural North Carolina, I was a Methodist pastor in rural North Carolina, and my spiritual director was a retired Baptist minister. Now, that's a long way from when it used to be the priests and nuns doing it, right? It's certainly widened out. And so about 30, maybe 40 years ago now, there began to be spiritual direction training programs. Programs that helped, if you felt like you had the gift of companioning someone else, of listening, of offering guidance, of creating that space where someone could listen to their own soul. If you had that gift, then you could go to a program where they would help you grow that gift, help you identify it and become more mature in this. So there began to be programs that would train. Now there are lots of programs. The first program really in this country and the most reputable one was in Baltimore called the Shalem Institute. And so a lot of folks went there. But now there are many all over the place. There used to be one associated with our seminary that's trained a lot of people. So it's a slightly more professionalized these days. It's still charismatic in that you want to identify whether you have the gift for spiritual direction. But then you can go and be trained to use that gift more faithfully. And that's what I'm going to spend the rest of our time, which isn't very long, talking about today. In this context, Like I said, it's increasingly professionalized. So you match the gift with training. I already said this, rose out of the rediscovery of the practice in Catholic circles, monasteries, but it's increasingly open to people of other Christian religious traditions. And now there's an organization with thousands of members called Spiritual Directors International. And there's spiritual direction in Jewish traditions and Muslim traditions and Hindu practitioners of spiritual. So all the religious traditions are discovering and rediscovering this need for spiritual companionship. One of the things that's important about spiritual direction is the need to distinguish it from other forms of professional companioning we have in our culture. So you might have an executive coach or a life coach, right? And that person's job is to help you identify your goals in life, take the steps you need to take to achieve them, which is great. That's not what spiritual direction is. Spiritual direction is not life coach. It's also not therapy or counseling. So, I mean, this is a very broad generalization. So it's not always this way. But typically, when in a counseling or a therapeutic relationship, we come because we have an identified problem. We have something that there's a place in our life because of anxiety or the way we relate with others that we're not functioning as well as we'd like. And we want help to get over that so we can function more efficiently and healthily in our life. So we come with an identified problem. So I remember once when I went to see a therapist about anxiety. That was our first conversation. What's the problem? And if you can imagine what it would be like to be over this problem in a year, what would it be like? So we had this sense, oh, this is where we're going. And when we get there, we can be done. You're feeling better. You're able now to drive through the mountains of West Virginia without sitting in the back seat with a blanket over your head, you know. So, yeah. Anyway, we don't need to go there. But right. So you're right. So spiritual direction is not problem focused. Spiritual direction is a relationship in which the goal is to bring our whole lives, joys and challenges, the whole thing, and lay it bare story by story before God. To notice where God is in every aspect of our lives. Now, sometimes it's a problem, right? And we'll talk through problems. But the point is to begin to say, where is the Spirit moving in this? Where is God's presence? How is God leading? How is God becoming increasingly known to you? Even in this problem. Even in this situation. So it's really about our whole lives. Our spiritual life is not just a part of our lives. It's not like we have my work life and my hobby life and my family life and, oh, over here's my spiritual life. No, the whole thing is your spiritual life. Your whole life is a playground of the Holy Spirit tumbling around, having a great time, wanting you to join in and notice what's going on. And in spiritual direction, it's a relationship where we're given the opportunity to bring our whole lives and say, where's the Spirit moving in this place? So in my spiritual direction relationship with Larry, I mean, I spend as much time talking about throwing a baseball with my kids as I did about, a struggle in prayer. Because the Spirit is in my throwing a baseball with my kids. That's where my spiritual life is. Oh, we also talked a lot about washing dishes. That was more in the fixing a problem area. But, right, every aspect of my life is open in spiritual direction. So I think on your handout, I thought it would be nice to have a definition. So on your handout, I did from a woman named Sue Pickering, her book on spiritual direction, where she names what this practice is and how it's being practiced today. And so I just wanted to offer this as one person's putting concrete words to this practice. Spiritual direction could be defined as taking place when one person, the director, prayerfully supports and encourages another person, the directee, to attend and respond to God. As a fellow pilgrim, the spiritual director accompanies the directee on this journey of faith. The real director is God, the Holy Spirit, who initiates and inspires the directee's deepening relationship with the Trinity, with his or her own self, with other people, and with the realities of life in the global village of the 21st century. Christian spiritual direction seeks to help directees dive deeper into prayer and draw closer to God in everyday life. Discover God's care in the midst of difficulties. Become aware of the sacred within the ordinary events of life, like washing dishes. honestly share with God their feelings, doubts, and questions. Become more like Christ and experience the fruits of the Spirit. Move from a preoccupation with their sinfulness to a graceful life of love and service. Now, I'm just curious. I mean, I've talked through this a little bit, and we've put this. I'm just curious, what is your reaction to that? Does that sound to you like, oh, wouldn't it be great to have someone in my life who helps me do that? Or maybe some of you already do, and you think, yes, I know exactly what that's like. Do you see how that's different from therapy or counseling? I'm just want to open this a little bit for some conversation, how you respond to this picture of relationship. Yeah, Ted.
Mm-hmm. And we spend talking, so
yes.
We crave someone who will listen to us even more, and so we keep on talking, but we will encounter someone who will listen.
Yes, exactly. The gift of having someone who gives you their full undivided attention in our culture is increasingly rare, as you say. And it is a beautiful gift, right? And so now we're more likely to seek out. It's an interesting, and culturally it's an interesting shift because, like you said, it's less likely that in our church we're going to have these kinds of informal relationships where we're listening to one another. But in a culture also where things about spirituality become increasing, more people are interested. They want to ask questions about the inner life and about life with God. So, but it's harder to find the places where that happens. And so you seek out this kind of relationship because it's increasingly rare in our culture. I just don't think there's a gift in human relationships deeper and more significant than the ability to offer someone your wholehearted physical presence and attention for more than 30 seconds. And when that's happened for you and someone offers you that, you understand how freeing and liberating and beautiful and healing it is. We've been in the first few weeks of my spiritual formation class at the seminary, so we've just been sharing our lives with one another. I have 37 students broken up into four different classes, and so each student's had 6 to 7 minutes just to share their spiritual journey. And the rest of us sit in a circle, and the rule is that we don't respond. We're just sharing, and then we're going to hold and honor one another's stories of life with God in our silent presence. And it's been, some of them have just said, this has been such a beautiful gift, because where have I been able to tell my story and share my heart without someone being afraid someone's going to correct me or tell me I'm on the wrong path or give me some advice? Just listen. We've just been freed to listen. It's been a real gift. Thank you for that. What else do you notice? Yeah.
I like the definition, and this is why. I don't think any of us would say that God is a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Hindu, or any other denomination. God is God. So if you have a spiritual director who belongs to a denomination, mm-hmm. could that direction minimize or detract from the Holy Spirit's guidance mm-hmm. by imposing the thought system mm-hmm. on the Holy Spirit's attempt to guide us?
Right.
And that would be my question. But I think this definition suggests that that isn't a factor.
Right.
That a spiritual director would not limit their direction by imposing their thought system on a directee.
Right. So that's exactly right. So remember last week we talked about letting go of agendas. And one of the places where this has to be practiced is in spiritual direction. A spiritual director cannot have an agenda for your life. They cannot have a path in mind that they think is the right spiritual path, and that their job is to get you along that. That is not how spiritual direction is practiced. Spiritual direction is practiced with a deep and abiding trust that God's Spirit is working already in your life. And what I do as the director, through my listening, my questioning, my pointing out, mostly listening and questioning, is to help you tune into the way the Spirit is working in your life without imposing a kind of structure on that. So now there are different schools of spiritual direction. Different people will be trained in maybe in a particular like an Ignatian model of spiritual direction. But one of the things people are noticing increasingly is the similarities between the movement of the way different schools of spirituality notice the movements of the spirit. And so even last week, I was talking about letting go of agendas and attachments, and someone who is deeply familiar with something called the Enneagram, which is a model of understanding self-knowledge it doesn't come out of a particular tradition. She noticed, she said, I see you're using similar language and concepts to the Enneagram, but I wasn't talking about the Enneagram. So we noticed those kinds of things. Yeah. So the whole goal is to really create the space, the conditions, for someone to be increasingly attentive to how the Spirit is working with them. So even in Ignatius, 16th century, when he's writing about spiritual direction, he says the most important thing for the director to do is to get out of the way so that God can deal directly with the creature. So that God can deal directly with the creature. But ironically, we need someone in the room to get out of the way to help us do that, right? So it comes both ways, yeah. What else do you notice about this? Does this seem kind of frightening to any of you that you would have this kind of, or does it? Do you have a draw to it? Yes.
I could see maybe having a problem with all the focus. I'm getting something out of this. This is happening to me, but I'm not giving anything back, or
yes.
I feel like I'm not being fair. It's not a give and take, and that's uncomfortable to me.
It can be. In this model, you've noticed that. I mean, there's a clear distinction between who the director is and who the directee is. And if I'm the director, it's similar in any caregiving profession. I understand that in this context, my role is to be available to and helpful to this person, which means that in another context, I got to go someplace else to get my needs met, right? In any caregiving, I mean, I say this to people preparing to be pastors. If you want to go into pastoral ministry because you need people to like you and you think you're going to have a relationship with them to meet your needs, then you're going to do more harm than good. And so you need to find places to get those needs met because you're there to serve and to be available for others. Now, there is more mutuality than that. So you're right, in this model, there is that. But it's also a gift. So one of the things, there aren't very many places in our lives where the whole focus is on, it's not narcissistic because it's a gift someone gives. I'm creating this space for you to be attentive to your life and how God is working in your life. But you've certainly noticed what can be. And for some folks, that might be why a more mutual form of spiritual companionship is really important, because you want or need to be in that give and take relationship. Yeah. Here in the back.
Working with people, but no one wants to talk about their soul.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be responsible for their soul.
Mm.
When they start to talk about it, they either blame on other people or the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get people to talk about their soul.
Yeah.
How are you?
Right. How is it with your soul? Right.
And I just sit and listen.
Just increasing more and more barriers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to hear, and Marilyn's my soulmate.
Okay.
But I would love to hear people just talk.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, with World War II people, I tend to get along with them better because they maybe more close to family or talking. But the younger generations, I'm like, I just wait. And it's more like an agenda, blame, or I don't have time.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot.
In terms, like, Margaret Gunther has been a writer and teacher on spiritual direction for a long time. And she says one of her images is for a spiritual direction is a midwife to the soul. Because you have to have the gentle, encouraging way of helping someone open up about that and kind of give birth to what the Spirit's trying to give birth within them. Bob, right? You mentioned Parker Palmer and my fondness for Parker Palmer, and you shared that image of the shy soul. So Parker Palmer's a Quaker, and he says, I think I said this 2 weeks ago, but I'll say it again, the soul is like a wild animal, right? It can survive for a long time under harsh conditions, but it's very shy, right? And if you want to see a wild animal, you don't go out in the forest and say, come out, wild animal, I'm here, where are you? You know, he says you get really still, and you get really quiet, and you wait. And I think and eventually that wild animal might show itself. And I think that's a beautiful image for what can happen in spiritual direction. Because a good spiritual director knows how to be patient and create those conditions. One of the conditions is non-judgment, right? I mean, it has to be a space without fear of judgment. So you're not afraid. And that sometimes it takes many months or a year of meeting and growing trust for the shy soul to feel like it can say what it needs to say and bring that out into the light. But it's such a gift and a beautiful miracle when it happens. Yeah. Yeah.
This feels rather risky, I think, because it's very countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really are not inclined to be comfortable thinking about being obedient,
mm-hmm.
first of all,
mm-hmm.
and putting other people first,
mm-hmm.
and being anything other than I'm in charge,
yes.
of it all.
Yes.
And somehow this laying this out, as I said, it just feels very risky.
Mm-hmm. It's deeply countercultural. It's deeply countercultural. And it does feel risky. I mean, the way it's practiced today, this emphasis on obedience is very unlike what it was a long time ago. So obedience, even the word obedience is related to the Latin word which means audire, which means to hear. So there's a part of obedience for me today is just that deep listening. So when my spiritual director tells me something, she doesn't tell me what to do. But I chew on her wisdom, and I try to take it to heart as best I can. You know, so there's a deep listening to her. Usually it's me doing most of the talking. But it is risky. Because think about how we've been describing the false self as defended, walled off. You know, I know who I am. And it's a precarious way to exist. But it feels necessary to get through the world. We might say we're well defended, right? And this is a context in which we're being invited to let the defenses down, right? And most of us don't know what that feels like. It feels unstable and risky. So a good spiritual direction, like I've said, knows how to create the space through their presence, their listening, their trust, where we can increasingly feel able to do that. Yeah, right. Anything else? Yeah.
So when you lose your
Well, that would have been, we're about halfway through because I haven't let y'all talk for the last 3 weeks, and I thought this would be new enough that we should let you talk. So the last section is on how to find a spiritual director. So that's a longer question for the next 30 seconds. Right. When I moved to, one of the things you do is first you recognize your longing, right? So if you read this and you said, my soul needs that kind of space. That's the first thing you do. You recognize the longing for that kind of companionship. Then you pray, and you begin to ask, God, help me in my life. Help me to be aware of where I can find a soul friend like this. Another thing you can do is begin to ask around. So you can ask your pastors. You can get on the website Spiritual Directors International and look for spiritual directors in this area. I often, when I'm talking to groups about spiritual direction, I say if there's a seminary close by, call the spirituality professor there or the pastoral care professor there. They might know. So it's often there are these informal networks. You know, someone knows someone and they're just kind of this, oh, I know this person who does this, or maybe in your area. So you just, you're patient. You keep your ears open. You know, if you've been interested in spiritual direction and randomly on some morning some guy shows up at your church and talks for an hour about it, you think, oh, maybe this is an opportunity for me to discover more about that. Yeah. It was hard for me when I moved. Like I said, I had a spiritual director for 8 years in North Carolina. And when I moved here, I knew I had to find a new spiritual director. And it was, I just had to be really patient. And I asked around, and I met with someone for about 6 months, and we just decided that it wasn't the best relationship for me at the time. And so I kept looking. And now Sister Paul has been my spiritual director for 2.5 or 3 years. And that's been a great relationship. So to your question, sir, I'm a Methodist minister teaching at a Presbyterian seminary with a Roman Catholic sister as my spiritual director. Yes. So anyway, once again today, you'll see there's lots on your handout that we didn't get to. But just to introduce the practice, I think you've got that. And I, again, appreciate your being here and your engagement and your attention to this. And next week, we'll talk about a Quaker. So we're going all over the place. Quaker Thomas Kelly. And he'll help us pull a number of these themes together. Till then, go in peace.